Belt. We are back. Happy Monday. We are very excited to be here with a very special guest, the host and creator of one of the very first paranormal podcasts I ever listened to. He is a researcher, a documentarian, an artist, and a filmmaker. Today, we get to speak with Mr. Derek Hayes of the Monsters Among Us podcast. Derek, how are you?
I'm great, guys. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for taking the time to be here and hang out with us today.
Of course. And if I'm the very first show you've ever listened to, you set the bar very low. It's pretty smart of you. That way you only have nowhere to go but up from there.
You sound like us. Likewise, you're actually probably one of my first paranormal podcasts that I jumped into.
Nice. You know, I was there at one point before the show. I was a fan and I had my own that I used to listen to. We're going to talk about this guy in a bit, but mine was actually David Flora. I used to listen to my garage as I was working on things. And I'm like, oh, if that guy can do it, anybody can do this. So I got, you know, kind of started my own. But no, it's funny how that, you know, kind of comes full circle there.
Yes. Yep, it does. You know, you and then we got like Tony from the Confessionals. You guys have been huge inspirations to us. And it just kind of motivated us to enter the ring, so to speak, and try to climb the ranks. And it's been a amazing process, you know, like watching you grow, watching Tony grow, because we started following back in the day when you guys were established, but now you're just kind of reaching these new pillars, and it's always encouraging and just simply amazing to watch that process unfold.
I appreciate that. And it's, you know, it's fun to watch other shows, you know, grow and reach those milestones as well. So congrats to you guys. You know, when I worked in LA and Hollywood and stuff, there was always this saying that a lot of my bosses had, it's, you know, it has nothing to do with talent or any of this stuff. It's just, can you withstand Hollywood long enough for it to be successful for you? And I feel like paranormal podcasting sort of the exact same thing. Can you weather the storm long enough to become popular? Can you weather the storm long enough to, you know, to become one of the bigger shows? And, you know, that's what it takes is repetition and stubbornness, I think.
I could definitely see that.
Yeah, we've got that in the bag, I believe. But yeah, when I was I've probably been listening for 6 or 7 years. Me and my kids would ride around. They'd always want to listen to Monsters Among Us. Put on Monsters Among Us. Put on Monsters Among Us.
I love when the kids are interested. It just, you know, cracks me up. Because I see myself as a, you know, 10-year-old watching Unsolved Mysteries or something. And, you know, being having the lights scared out of me, but still wanting more, you know. And yep. It's fun to go full circle and be that person now.
Yeah.
I can imagine.
I text my youngest boy. He's 14 now. I'm like, guess who I'm interviewing tonight? He's like, who? I'm like, Derek from Monsters Among Us. He's like, so is he going to be like in-house? You going to meet him? Or I'm like, next best thing, buddy. Next best thing. I guess that leads to the first question, really, which I'm sure you've been asked tons of times. What sparked your interest in the paranormal? I heard you mention Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah, you know, there was an event that actually kind of got the ball rolling when I was about, I want to say 8 to 10 years old, something like that, in the woods of Southeast Ohio. My brother and a friend of ours were kind of tromping around in the woods behind our house, and we saw what is now known as an ABC, an alien big cat. This was like a, leopard-sized animal of some sort, all black, huge creature, long flowing tail, kind of darted from left to right across the field. And you know, of course, you know, as little kids, we were enthralled, terrified, but enthralled. And we ran home, and I remember telling my dad about it. And, you know, there's some argument about how this actually went down, but I remember him saying, you know, I saw that thing a couple of weeks ago. And he claims that he saw it after we saw it, but whatever. The whole point is, it was sort of instantly validated for me. So, you know, that was my gateway. You know, it's a gateway drug into the paranormal. I started looking at Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, aliens, ghosts. You know, every little bit of strangeness I can get my hands on, it's really fascinated me. And I was lucky enough to grow up in the 80s. You know, you had Unsolved Mysteries. Toward the tail end, you had sightings, you had In Search Of, and a handful of documentaries and that sort of thing. So there was stuff out there. You know, there's material out there. So it just fed the fire. And, you know, I moved on to just regular film. I went to film school, and like I mentioned earlier, I worked in Hollywood for a decade. working in props and behind the scenes and that sort of thing. And just tried to write. I was trying to be a writer and a director. This is the whole point of moving to LA. And believe it or not, that's hard to do for, you know, even a talented person. And I'm not saying that I am, but it's hard to do for anybody that's, you know, talented. So I sort of looked for an outlet, and podcasts were coming up, and I thought, you know, I know a few things. I got a few ideas, and one thing led to another. And 8 years later, here I am.
That is awesome.
That is awesome. So with that, I have a interesting question. One I thought of on the way here, and it fits kind of properly into this conversation where we're at currently. In your journey of doing the paranormal, researching the paranormal, and doing it for as long as you have, is there anything that you now have changed your mind on?
Everything. Everything. I think everything I have changed my mind on at some point. You know, when I went into this, I was certain that Bigfoot couldn't exist. There was no way in my mind that I love the stories. I love the folklore. I love the possibility of it. But as a rationally thinking person, I thought there's absolutely no way this could happen. The more and more you dig and more you hear from witnesses, you know, eyewitnesses, which is what my show is essentially based on, I started to doubt, you know, that skepticism a little bit. And now I can't sit here and say I do believe, but I'm not so certain that they aren't out there, if that makes any sense. And that sort of philosophy has been applied to all of these subjects, really. You could ask me at any point, do you believe in ghosts? And I'll give you a different answer each day, I think, just based on the stories I hear, you know, based on what has happened recently. You know, have I lost somebody in my life, something like that? That always influences how I feel about a lot of these subjects. So to be honest with you, it's a gray area. The whole thing is a very big gray area for me, and the needle goes back and forth at any given time.
Yeah, I can agree with that. I'm more Steve is my skeptic. I am on the other end. I'm the dude that I'll almost literally believe every single thing is possible until proven otherwise. But there have been certain cases where I'm like, yeah, right. The same thing. Yeah, right. There's no way they're actually doing that. There's no way that's actually a reality. And then, like you said, you keep digging around, you keep listening to people, and you're like, you know what? I might have actually gotten that one wrong.
Yeah. It's just that little bit of doubt. All you need is that seed of doubt planted somewhere.
Yep.
And, you know, it kind of itches at you. And the more you hear, a perfect example of that is I received a lot of calls recently from the state of Kansas about, I don't know, some sort of upright creature. I don't know if it was Bigfoot, Dogman, Pale Crawler. It's some sort of humanoid that people are seeing. And, you know, the first couple times I got the call, I'm thinking, all right, you know, it's Kansas. What could be hiding in Kansas? This makes no sense. I've been there. It's flat. There's, you know, there's nothing around. But the calls just kept coming and kept coming. And it wasn't just that there was a lot of them. It was the quality of the call. You know, the witness's voice, I could hear it. You know, I could tell that at least they believed what they were telling me. So, you know, all these things start snowballing a little bit. And now I'm thinking, what is in Kansas? You know, what might be hiding there, you know, in the corn or the weed or whatever they have growing out there.
Since you started out in the backwoods of Ohio, now you live in the mountains outside of LA, which of the two locations are weirder?
Oh, well, those are different reasons for each place, I think. You know, Ohio is classically weird in that there's so many different stories to come out of that state. You have the Frogman, you have the Grassman, you have Bessie up in Lake Arrowhead, tons and tons of haunted locations, the Ohio Reformatory, you know, Franklin Castle, stuff like that. But then, of course, you get to California and it's a whole nother animal. I mean, California is the size of several countries around the world. So it's a much bigger sampling, I guess, to uncover some stuff. But as far as weirdness is concerned, I got to stay with Ohio. I mean, you go back there and I feel like anything can happen there. That said, the people here are certainly weirder. There's no doubt about that. Maybe I'm one of them, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, we We did a conference in Ohio this last fall, and yeah, can confirm. Weird place.
It's which beautiful, one did though. You
do? It was a new one that just it was the inaugural year of 40 and Airwaves, where it was just primarily just podcasts. Like six podcasts got together and did a weekend thing.
Oh, awesome!
It was a good time.
Where did they do that one?
At
Ada.
Yeah, Ada, Ohio Northern University. There on the campus. Yeah. It was awesome.
Nice. Beautiful campus. I went to school up that direction. Yeah.
Oh, awesome. Beautiful area too. Beautiful area.
Well, that's the funny thing about, you know, I guess both of those states is each corner you pick is a different terrain. You know, I'm from Southeast Ohio where it's very mountainous. We're technically from Appalachia. And I went to school in the other Northwestern corner, and it's very flat, Midwest style. You go up a little north and there's the Great Lakes and you have that, I dare say, Cape Cod feel to it. I realize it's a lake and not the ocean, but it's just kind of that beach community feel. So, and then, of course, anybody that knows anything about California knows that each pocket of California is completely different than the next. So maybe that variety, you know, plays a hand in keeping both of those states a little strange.
Derek, have you had any paranormal experiences throughout your journeys?
I have a couple. Yeah. There's one that I love to tell. Man, I was probably about 13 or 14 years old when my grandparents moved to Florida. They retired my grandfather was the chief of police in our tiny little town. And he had some altercation where he was almost killed in action, and it was kind of this big deal. So they decided to retire early and move to Florida. So they bought this house trailer in Jacksonville, this little trailer park. We went down to visit them. And I remember walking down the hallway, and in this spare room they had, it's just a little day bed with a ceiling fan and a set of blinds on the window. Each time I would walk by in my peripheral, I would see a Native American standing there. And he would have the full bonnet, you know, feathered bonnet on, and you could see things hanging off of him, like beads and strings and things. And he looked to be doing some sort of dance. His hands would go up over his head, and his knees would kick up to his chest. And every time I walked by, I would see it out of my peripheral. But when I would turn to look, there would be nothing there but a set of blinds. And this happened, I don't know, three or four times throughout the visit. We were there maybe a week. And I guess toward the end of that, we had a big family, so a lot of us were sleeping on the floor there in the living room, a lot of us kids. And on the last night, there was some sort of ruckus where someone or something was pounding on the sides of the house trailer as we were sleeping at like 3 a.m. And we'd go up one side and come down the other. And I think maybe up underneath the floor, they would hear something. And everybody got up and looking around. Of course, I slept through the entire thing, but my dad, you know, recounts this story to me on the regular. But I don't know if it's tied in with a Native American that I saw those several times, but there was something certainly weird, you know, in that area. And I wonder if there maybe it was some sort of encampment there at some point or something like that. What the history was in that area that caused that manifestation to happen.
Steve actually, oddly enough, has a similar experience to that.
Yeah. My cousin actually had almost like exceptionally similar experience about seeing when he was young toddler, he would talk about a man with a bear head dancing in the spare room around a fire.
Oh, wow.
And it culminated in, after seeing it and telling his parents and them kind of writing it off, it culminated in my aunt used to have this collection of like stuffed animals she'd always keep on this rocking chair. And she came in one day and they were stacked up almost like a totem pole in the middle of the room.
Wow.
And it kind of his parents actually saw whatever this being, this entity was, moved down the hallway, and it kind of confirmed the sighting that he was having as a child. But it is crazy. Very similar.
Where did this take place?
In Illinois.
Illinois. Okay. Well, there's a lot of Native American presence there in Illinois, so that makes sense. And I love the detail of the bear head.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
That's what kind of set it off. Like because he was young, probably maybe 2 or 3 years old. So you like at some point the imagination, it has to go beyond your imagination, you know.
Sure.
To have details like that.
Yeah. And he saw a fire as well, huh?
Yeah. Said he was dancing around a fire.
See, what I saw was just the person, and it was a silhouette. I couldn't make out a lot of features. It was literally just a silhouette, also in my peripheral. So the details weren't there, but I didn't see a fire or anything like that. It was just this guy dancing on the same level that I was, you know, and we were however high a house trailer is, 5 feet off the ground, something like that. So I always thought that was strange. You know, if it was a ghost, why would it be hovering up off the ground like that? If it was some sort of rewound video or, you know, something like that, what they say with that type of haunting.
That is interesting to think about it that way too. I've never thought about it like that. Why would it be in the floor of your trailer versus not like his head poking up through?
That's exactly what you should expect, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And the only thing I could think is maybe at some point the ground was higher up and you
possible
know, erosion or whatever has brought it down and it just coincidentally happens to be the same. But, you know, this is my own sighting and I'm still trying to debunk it. So that's just the nature of how I deal with this.
Yeah. And actually, to be honest with you, I wasn't even thinking of that story, Steve. I was thinking about your dad with all of your artifacts.
Oh, yeah, I didn't think about that either. I actually have a pretty vast, I don't have them in here right now, collection of Native American artifacts. There was a, what we believe, possibly an encampment in some ground that was being farmed, and it was just destroying all of these artifacts. So whenever I'd get out and walk, I would just pick them up. And one day I came home after high school and there's these big granite, I call them grinding bowls. Some people call them medicine bowls. They have a big indentation where.
Oh yeah. Pestle native, and mortar.
Yeah, exactly. I come home and they're out on my front porch and I'm like, what is going on? And then my dad's standing there and he's like, those have to stay outside. I'm like, why? And he goes, he's like, I was trying to take a nap today and I kept waking up to the sound of drums in the house. And I'm like,
oh wow.
All right.
That's funny. Cause I have my Native American artifact collection is literally like 2 feet away from me here. Arrowheads and stuff, similar experience. When I was a kid, my aunt was building a house. And I, you know, went to high school with some people that lived around there. Like, hey, if you want to find some arrowheads, go to this spot. And we were there 1 weekend helping out, and they happened to be plowing that field or disking or something. So I, you know, caught the guy. I'm like, hey, can we look around? He's like, take whatever you want. I'm just tearing them up anyway. So I filled a whole, you know, display box full of little point heads and stuff like that. So I haven't had any experiences with mine, unfortunately. I think I would probably welcome that kind of experience right now. But, yeah, I'm still hopeful, maybe.
Yeah, that's I could talk arrowheads all day, actually. But I'm curious as to how you feel like being a part of the paranormal community and having let me figure out how to say this. The Mirrored Men phenomenon. Mm-hmm. That is pretty like that's credited to you and the experiences that have come forward. How does that feel to have something like that is now like phenomena wide being tethered back to you and your show?
You know, in hindsight, I think I'm pretty lucky. I think that certainly helped the show grow a bit, because for a while it was the only place you could get any material on, you know, the Mirrored Men. It's a surprise, frankly. I did not expect that in the least. And, you know, I tell this story all the time. The very first Mirrored Men tale came in, I think, in my first season, maybe the first 6 or 7 episodes. And back then it was a half hour show. I was doing this as a hobby, just kind of an outlet, I guess, really. And I used to beg my friends like, hey, do you have any ghost stories you can share on my show? I'll pretend you're a stranger. Don't worry. And, you know, from college, I remember my friend Matt would always tell me this story about these three strange men that kind of made him miss time, gave him missing time, I guess is a better way to put that. So, of course, I give him a call. I'm like, Matt, will you tell this story? And 2 minutes and 32 seconds later or whatever, it's over. You know, they have the story. I play it on the air and I think that's it. A couple of weeks later, the calls just start flooding in. I get a couple of written submissions. I get a couple of phone calls. And next thing I know, I have half a dozen of these stories that are almost identical. You know, three men that look the same, move the same, act the same, strange weather, odd weather, rural locations, missing time. A lot of the same elements are there. And over the years, I think I've received going on 3 or 4 dozen of these entries now. So I got to name the phenomena, which, you know, I was pretty excited to do. Most people don't get that opportunity. So the second I realized this was some sort of trend, like, well, we got to have a name for this. So I was thinking of Lauren Coleman, you know, he got to name all sorts of creatures in the 70s. I'm like, man, what a rare opportunity to actually get to name something. So I spent a lot of time, you know, coming up with the name of these things. So to answer your question, I'm incredibly lucky. I feel like that's where I am. I don't have a single answer for anybody. You know, I'm just as clueless on all this as anybody else is, but I absolutely love these calls. I think they're spooky as hell, but they're a lot of fun.
Whenever you were, I'm kind of glad the conversation pans out the way things do, because I was thinking about it earlier and then now we're full circle again. But because you were talking about how, like, you'll be lit up with Kansas calls.
Mm.
And I was thinking about it then, but now I get to drive it back. It's a cool thought to sit here and think how, because your show is formatted completely different from a lot of people out there. And we all do our own specific avenue, but it's kind of cool to think that you essentially, not literally, but you're almost like a 911 operator at times. Because I could not imagine the feeling of going through the voicemails and going through the submissions and seeing that happen, seeing Kansas light up all of a sudden out of nowhere with this cryptid or humanoid coming in, or you see something happening in Florida. Like it's like real time tracking at times of these paranormal events, which is fascinating.
It's challenging, frankly. You know, you always have to have your head on a swivel, as they say in the profession here. When these calls come in, you got to remember all this stuff. I mean, it doesn't do you any good if you don't recall that, oh, this is the fifth Kansas call I've had in a couple of weeks that describes something similar to this. You know, if those first five are already gone from my brain, it doesn't work out. So I wonder how much I miss, frankly. You know, I get, I don't know, half a dozen calls a day, something like that. You know, they come in pretty quickly. So how many times have I missed a trend? And that's why I play all the calls. I don't leave anything on the table if I don't have to. If it's a bad quality or, you know, something like that, I can't play it. But even the calls that don't quote unquote interest me, that aren't really in my, you know, wheelhouse, I guess, I'll still play those, because you never know how they're going to match up or they're going to inspire somebody else to tell their story or, you know, something like that. So you really can't be a gatekeeper on any of this. But as far as uncovering all these trends, it's usually a happy accident when it does happen. There's another set in Montana where they're talking about some sort of goat man type creature, a hooved entity that's hitchhiking on the roads out there, which is, you know, intertwined with a lot of Native American legends, the Deer Woman and that sort of thing. So it's really fun to explore that. And of course, recently we had this is one of the best calls I've had in a long time, but we had a call out of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, of a, I guess, a homeless woman that turned into a moose right in front of this lady's eyes.
That's awesome.
And, you know, the moose kind of just looks at her and then tears off through the trees. And then, as if that wasn't enough, this trucker comes flying in between the moose and this witness, who's terrified, of course, at this point. And the trucker says, you know, I saw exactly what happened. Get out of here. I'm going to try to keep this thing off of you. So, you know, there was an instant witness to this thing. So, you know, these stories are pretty wild. And when you get to uncover a trend, it's pretty exciting. I feel like one of the X-Files folks when that sort of happens.
Absolutely. That is awesome. Absolutely, man. That is fantastic.
To change pace a little bit, you recently had a awesome thing happen to you. You produced and wrote and filmed a documentary called Shadows in the Desert, High Strangeness in the Borrego Triangle.
Yeah. I don't know if that happened to me or if I forced it upon myself, but one way or another, it took place. Yeah, we just wrapped that thing up. We wrapped it up a long time ago, and it's been in kind of limbo for years with the distributor and everything, but it finally released on March 5th. So it's, streaming right now on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, you know, that kind of place. So finally, after 4 years of work, a global pandemic and a bunch of other stuff, we finally got it out. So pretty excited about that.
That is awesome. I didn't realize it was that long in the making until you just mentioned it.
Yeah, we were funded the day, basically the day everything locked down was when our Kickstarter ended. So we were supposed to go film that next week or whatever. And it was almost 2 full years before we were able to get out there even once to film. And we were out there 3 different times. So it added some time, but you know, that extra time really allowed us to get the film as tight as it possibly could be. So it's, you know, a silver lining, I guess.
It is excellent and well put together. And it's the cinematography is beautiful.
Thank you.
It's you and David Flora from Blurry Photos. Mm-hmm. Are you guys have history together?
Yeah. Well, like I said, he was, you know, my podcasting hero there for a while. I would listen to him and his partner Dave do Blurry Photos for years before I started my show. So he was on my radar, and somehow I got on his. And once I got this idea in my head, I knew it was too big for me to do, especially, you know, doing the show weekly. So I was looking for partners, and I thought David's a great researcher. You know, he's really good with all that material, and he's a lot of fun to be around. You know, I've met him a few times at different conferences and been on his show, and he's been on mine. So it was a no brainer to team up with him, and it worked out really well. You know, I think we worked really well together.
Yeah. You guys had excellent chemistry in there. It was, that's why I'd asked, because you guys riff off each other and throw ideas back and forth. Like you've been there before and done it for years.
Well, we haven't. we're great actors then, apparently.
You had me convinced.
I loved the intro to the documentary. That was beautiful. I love the nostalgia feel to it. Like, it just puts you in this zone where you're like, all right, I know what I'm in for. Like, I know this is like, it does in a weird way, because, you know, me and Steve were also born in the 80s, and we grew up with Unsolved Mysteries and X-Files and all, and it just kind of fits for guys like us. It like I said, it just puts you in that mindset. You're like, this is familiar. I like this. Scratches, I like it a lot. Yes, yeah, scratches that itch.
Well, there was a lot of influence there, you know, paying homage to those shows, but also, when you go out to the desert, out to these desert communities, it's sort of like going back in time. You know, some of these places don't have much of cell phone service. So you're out there without a phone, and, you know, everything just seems to be a few years behind. Now, I'm not saying it's the 80s out there, but it's not a far stretch to think, you know, the 80s weren't that far away back in, you know, Borrego Springs or wherever. So anytime I'm back there, I always feel that nostalgic feel to it. So we definitely had to push that direction. And, you know, like I said, I'm a baby of the 80s. So, of course, we had the synth music and the neon look logo and, you know, all that stuff. We had to go for broke there.
Ah, dude, I loved it. I thought it fit perfect. Like I said, it brings it home for me. And not to jump to the end of the documentary right now, but I loved the outro equally. And I don't know why, but... because I love watching documentaries that show the process, which you guys did. You know, you may not have like these big fantastical happenings going on, but you show the process. You show going out to there to these locations and talking to these witnesses and doing all of that. And then for some reason, and I cannot explain to you why, but at the end of it, whenever the outro music begins to kick in and you guys are talking, you have this feeling of satisfaction that I can't explain. Like it's almost, you know what it feels like? It feels like the pilot to a TV series. That's what it feels like. Like, this is the pilot episode. This is literally only the beginning, ladies and gentlemen. We are coming back bigger and better.
It's funny you say that, because that's sort of the idea we had, in that this was just an introductory course basically to this area, this brand new Borrego Triangle that we coined the phrase. You know, it didn't exist before us. I mean, the area did and the phenomena did, but we hadn't packaged it, and no one's packaged it before us. So for us, this was, hey, this is the spot, this is all the stuff that's going on there, the gate's wide open, you know. And the beauty of this is California's largest state park, and the great thing about that place is you can go to all of these places. All you got to do is stay alive. I mean, it's sometimes harder, you know, easier said than done, but you can go there. You can camp out anywhere. There's a cool rule out there at the park that you can basically set up a tent anywhere. I mean, there's a few restrictions, but if you're off the road, no fire and you set up a tent, you look up in the sky, you're going to see something. I promise you, you're going to see something weird. Anytime we were there looking up, we saw something weird. Whether or not that's paranormal, if it's aliens, I don't know, but it's certainly exciting, you know, to look up there and try to figure it out. But like I said, yeah, this was just an introductory to this area. And that ending is, okay, this is what we found. It's yours now. You take the rest of this and take the next step.
That's beautiful. Like, because that dude, I'm telling you, as someone who obviously didn't have a conversation with you prior watching that documentary, that's literally how I even made sure that I wrote it down and made a note of it because it was so impactful. Like it just felt right, man. And I think that's so important in that process of making that feeling of like, we'll be back. This is our pilot episode. And it was just beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. I just can't get over the outro to it. It was fantastic.
I appreciate that. And I'll tell you, our editor, Matt Van Hosen, probably appreciates that more because he worked really hard on, you know, putting tons and tons of footage together. And he cut that ending. And basically that was the first version he showed us. And I'm like, you got it. Perfect. You nailed it on the first try. So
that's awesome.
That was one little bit we really didn't have to mess with.
Yeah, when it's right, it's right, man.
Yeah. That's right. There was plenty of other things that weren't right for the longest time. So we made up for it. Don't worry.
What initially was kind of the catalyst that put your eyes on the area of the Borrego Triangle?
Well, you know, my wife and I do a ton of camping out here. We live in Southern California, just outside of LA, as you said earlier. And there's all kinds of outdoor activities out here and opportunities. And Anzabrego Desert State Park was one of them. We'd gone there a few times. We saw the super bloom there. In the wintertime, it's a great place to go because it's cold everywhere else and it'll still be 80 degrees there. So we would camp there and I kept hearing these stories. I'd get a call from a person here and there. I'd catch it in a book or on a mention on a TV show or something like that. So I knew these stories existed. And when I got out there, I'd go to the bookstores, you know, I'd go to these little locations and there was nothing. There was no films. There was no books. There was no media whatsoever on the paranormal side of the park. So that was my first inkling that something needed to happen. Now, I didn't know if it was a book or, you know, a separate podcast or, you know, it ended up being a documentary. But in one way or another, I was going to expose, for lack of a better term, expose this area, you know, and share these stories with people and share the fact that there's a collection of activity that's going on out there. So, you know, once I had that idea going, it was just poking and prodding, trying to find the quickest, easiest route and history and film. So it kind of made sense.
Out of there's a ton of high strangeness in the documentary. We don't want to get into everything because we encourage people to all go check out Apple TV, Amazon Prime, purchase the documentary, watch it. It is worth it. It is awesome. Some of the weirdness that caught my eye was the 8-foot skeleton right off the rip. If you want to touch on
that, that was going to be my next question too. Is what's everybody's favorite part of that documentary? Because I have mine as well, which is different than that. So,
well, Kyle, I'll answer yours first.
Oh, that was Steve with the skeleton. Okay, you're answering me first.
I'm answering you first. There is no favorite. Everybody, it seems like every person has a different one.
Yeah.
The 8-foot skeleton is high up there, though. The Bigfoot stuff, a lot of people are really interested in. The ghost lights, especially on the Goat Canyon trestle may or may not have caused a wreck. Those are the highlights. But yeah, that 8-foot skeleton. Now, essentially, the legend is that people way back in the day, this was an area that started off with prospecting, at least for Europeans. They discovered gold and silver in the area, and they were doing some dry panning and that sort of thing, had some mines. So there were a lot of prospectors in the area, and they would report seeing these piles of rocks that would come to life and move at night. They would, you know, the pile would be there in the morning, and the next morning it would be gone. And they saw these, they almost looked like gray aliens walking around that glowed in the dark. Their skin glowed in the dark. They would see those. And then one of the other things was this 8-foot skeleton. And in its chest was a burning lantern kind of lodged in there. And it just kind of lumbered around the slopes here and there. And what David and I kind of deducted from all these stories was that these may have been tales made up to keep people out of different mining claims. You know, hey, there's an 8-foot skeleton around here. That might be enough to keep you from looking for my gold mine, you know. But the stories persisted and, for a lot longer than these guys were mining. So I don't know if there was some truth to it or if these, you know, maybe it was already a legend and they just kind of piggybacked on it. Like, oh, you know, this legend already existed. I'll retell it to try to keep people out of there. But little things like that where it's a little ambiguous. Is this real? Is this not real? Would poke up from here and there, but that 8-foot skeleton just kept coming up and coming up, and the visual is just too much for us to ignore, so we certainly had to bring him up.
Yeah, speaking of the visual, I'm not sure who did the illustrations, but
that was Jonathan Dodd, actually.
Awesome.
They were excellent. Excellent.
Yeah. Yeah, he nailed that in. Again, our editor brought those to life. You know, they worked together and did them in layers so that they could animate everything, and just watching those come to life was pretty incredible. And it David and I had the plan from the beginning. You know, we didn't want to do reenactments. They're kind of corny. You know, we've seen them. Unless you have a lot of money, they usually don't look good. So what else could we do? And we both kind of settled on art. So we found our artist, Jonathan Dodd, out of the East Coast there. He does a lot of work for a lot of paranormal podcasts. And we went to our editor and like, hey, what can you do to bring John's art to life? And those two got together and the result was just incredible. There's some Bigfoot imagery in there that's pretty spooky.
Hey, Holocult, the weather's getting nice. And you know what that means? It's cryptid hunting season. And the first rule to cryptid hunting is good footwear. That's why we're excited to announce our partnership with Tecovas Boots. When you're out hunting the Dogman or stalking Chupacabra, you don't have time to break in boots. That's why Tecovas is so nice. They have first wear comfort. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with their styles when you're out hunting cryptids.
And let me tell you, their styles are on point. I've always considered getting me a pair of snakeskin boots, and their pair is mint. They also have crocodile boots, caiman boots, ostrich boots, regular leather boots. They have it all, and it's ridiculously awesome. You can even stop by the local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and a friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. So just imagine yourself getting a pair of legitimate snakeskin Hollow Sky branded boots. How awesome would that be?
Nothing is going to intimidate a dog man like a nice pair of gator skin boots. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's TECOVAS.com. They offer free shipping on all boots as well as free returns and exchanges and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Yeah, just watching the illustration of that skeleton meander through the desert and hearing the take on the folklore of the miner actually hearing the bones rattle as it goes over the hill was excellent. Excellent.
It almost makes just full of stories like that.
It almost makes you wonder, like, because I think like what you guys were talking about, how it could have been a story that the miners projected to keep people away from their claim. But it almost makes you wonder, to a degree, did that turn into like some form of tulpa?
Certainly possible.
You know, and manifested on its own because so many people started putting thought and energy and everything into it. If that may be the case to more current sightings.
And I certainly don't know how, you know, that philosophy works, you know, the tulpa. I know the idea behind it, but David and I were exploring some of the geological details, I guess, of the park. And there's a lot of quartz in that area and huge deposits of quartz in certain areas. And what we learned is there's a lot of electricity that can be stored and created by this quartz. It's not a far stretch to say, you know, if you were to create a tulpa, I imagine you'd need some sort of energy source. There's plenty of quartz and plenty of energy under the ground out there. Could there, you know, could it be a tie-in somewhere? Again, I'm not smart enough to know how any of that stuff works, but I'm smart enough to pull at those threads and like, oh, is there any possibility there? So places like that with that sort of potential just makes it a lot more fun. You know, you never know. And if not, you know, if not the skeleton or, you know, something else like that, then aliens or, you know, Bigfoot or ghost or, you know, whatever. There's all sorts of other things going on that could still be tied to that same activity.
I also loved that whenever you focused on a phenomenon, you also had theories as to what could be like, what could explain the phenomenon. Like you had the geologists on there talking about the quartz and the tumbleweeds and that's Monsters Among Us fashion, trying to get to the bottom of it. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. You know, I've always believed long before I started this show or, you know, my podcast that if something can be debunked, we should debunk it and then move on to the next thing because, you know, that gets the easy ones out of the way. What's left, you know, that's the stuff you're like, oh, okay, here's the stuff we couldn't explain. What's behind all this? And we attacked the park the same way. There was a few things in there that we thought we could explain, we could debunk, and we certainly tried it. You know, we didn't try to pull the wool over anybody's eyes or anything. If we thought it was a little iffy, we were certainly eager to say so. And there was plenty out there that we couldn't explain. So, you know, there's plenty of mystery there left.
What did you think about the woman you talked to that saw the military men with a specific patch on their shoulders?
Yeah, that was Maddie. She was one of our first witnesses that came forward, actually. And her story is fascinating because if you go there, it doesn't take you long to realize there's a ton of military presence there. There's a few shots in the film where there's a lot of helicopters circling us at any given point. And that's only a portion of what we got or what we experienced. Rather, we would go out to the middle of nowhere. I mean, we would drive on this dirt road for 20 miles and we'd get out of the cars, we'd get set up. Seconds later, a helicopter would come right overhead and, you know, circle around a few times and you kind of disappear off into the distance. And that happened over and over and over again. So I don't know if they were interested in what we were doing, if it was a coincidence, if they were just messing with some people they saw out in the middle of the desert, but the activity was there and the military was there throughout the park. And for her to have that UFO experience, essentially she saw a UFO in the next morning at the diner she worked at. She experienced these strange military men with weird insignia on their uniforms, something she wasn't familiar with. And they kind of behaved strangely when she asked questions. And she sort of thought that there was some sort of connection to that UFO because after the UFO, a couple jets actually were scrambled to that area to try to intersect it. So she thought this whole thing came together and we're not certain that it didn't. She seemed pretty convinced. And like I said, there's tons of activity in that area. So it certainly is on par.
Yeah, I asked that because we did an episode on the Collins Elite. Have you ever heard of them?
I'm not familiar, no.
They're a military military group. And I think Ryan from Somewhere in the Sky is kind of teed off on it a little bit. I didn't hear him drop the name. But they look at UFO phenomenon through a religious lens. And okay. They were convinced that they're all demons. They also spent years watching people practicing the occult because they were convinced that people practicing in the occult, like your Aleister Crowleys and stuff like that, they were opening portals. And once these people were doing that, they noticed significantly higher activity of UFOs and strangeness in said area. So they were trying to essentially seed out the connection to all of it and keep close tabs. Like anybody that they thought was an occultist or a practicing witch, you were on their list. They watched you.
So I'm probably on a list is what you're trying to get.
Probably.
You know, no, I'd heard of that group, but I'd never known the name. Or I didn't know they had a name. I, you know, mostly based on what you mentioned, Ryan Sprague, he was in the film. He brought it up there toward the end, discussing Maddie's actual case there. So that all kind of goes in line. And I guess I wished I'd known they existed. We could have dug a little deeper there.
Yeah. And through rumors that we've heard, we hear that they are still active. They're out there still doing their thing. And that, when you describe the insignia, like, that is the first thing my brain went to. I'm like, it's got to be these guys.
That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The Archangel was one of the insignia.
It was that particular insignia that I was like, it's got to be these guys.
Yeah.
And what's his name? Wrote the book about it.
Nick Redfern.
Nick Redfern wrote a book on the Collins Elite. Fantastic. Fantastically written. But the way they go into it and the things they look at, very interesting. If you haven't heard of it, I would highly recommend checking it out. But that was one of my, I love conspiracies. I love those types of encounters. And like having that in that documentary just made it that much more for me.
Yeah. And obviously we didn't know about it because we didn't include it. And this is the first time hearing of the Collins Elite. Is that right?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So yeah, I really wished we could have dug deeper on that. And it's something maybe for the sequel, I guess, if we ever get there. But that wasn't our only run-in with the military as well. We were researching some Bigfoot activity there. And there's a place called Dead Man Hole, which in the late 1800s, some men were found dead there. Essentially, they were strangled. They were bludgeoned to death. But the strange thing about it is that all their papers, all their money and everything was still on their person. So it wasn't seen as a robbery per se. So they weren't real sure what was going on. And finally, some people tracked a creature into one of the caves up, you know, in the hills above the area, killed it and supposedly took it back to San Diego. Now, when we went to investigate this area, we pull up to where Dead Man Hole is on the map. And to our surprise, it's right smack dab in the middle of a military training facility, some sort of survival school, I believe for the Navy. If I remember, David usually knows all this stuff. I think it was for the Navy, but, if you look out there, it's a big location, several dozen acres, probably more than that, maybe a couple hundred acres. We couldn't get anywhere near it. We went to the gate, tried to explain we're looking for Bigfoot. Of course, they weren't interested whatsoever in letting us in. So, you know, we were forced to stand on the sidelines and kind of peek over the fence. But how strange that one location happened to be right there on, you know, the most popular Bigfoot spot in the park, or in the triangle rather, is right here in this military training facility. I thought it was really strange.
Definitely suspicious.
Very. Yeah.
Maybe a coincidence, but certainly suspicious.
And all, I mean, your experiences with the helicopters and the fact that the Dead Man's Hole is now property of the military kind of leads credence to Maddie's sighting, you know?
Yeah.
It's wild. Did you have any experiences or feelings while you were out there that kind of was off kilter? Anything that really stood out to you?
Well, you know, I'll be honest with you. It was pretty hot when we were out there. Yeah. It was in the 120s.
Miserable.
120s. Yeah, it was miserable. So feeling things didn't exactly happen. You know, people say, I got cold chills or whatever. You weren't getting cold chills. You know, the devil could be rubbing your back and you wouldn't feel it. So that sort of didn't happen. But we did see something really strange one night. We were on our way back. I think it was from Devil's Hole doing the research for that day. We were driving back into Borrego Springs, which is all the way down in the valley. So you come over this big ridge and you drop down a couple thousand feet. And when we come over the ridge, off in the distance, floating above the Salton Sea, which is California's largest inland body of water, were these, I don't know, I want to say like five or six orange balls of light. It looked almost exactly like the Phoenix lights. And this thing was way in the distance and it was massive. So we pull over, we get onto walkies, like everybody pull over, and our cameraman gets out and he's like, I don't have the equipment to shoot this. It's so far away. I'm like, get whatever you can, you know, shoot whatever you can. So Chris, amazing photographer, he just didn't have the equipment, shoots what he can. And the funny thing is, we didn't use the footage. We couldn't find a place for it in the film. It just didn't fit anywhere. So David and I put it in our pocket and we released the film. And legally, I'm not allowed to talk about it yet, but you guys will be able to see the footage by the end of this year. It will be used in something else in another project. So I'm happy to say that that footage is not going to go to waste, but it was pretty exciting to see what it was, especially knowing that a couple of years later, I think last summer, over in 29 Palms, which is about 60, 70 miles to the north of where we saw this, the exact same thing was filmed right over top of the military base up there. So whatever those two things are, they're the same thing. I don't know if it's military flares, if it's one of these Delta craft that everybody's talking about, or something completely different altogether. In my mind, it's the same thing. So we saw whatever that was, and we got it on film.
That's awesome.
That is awesome.
That's awesome.
The funny thing about that is, I always make fun of people that do this. They'll be telling me a story like, oh yeah, a ghost was in my kitchen, you know, doing the dishes. And then I just kind of got tired of watching and I went to bed. And I'm like, how can you get tired of watching the ghost and go to bed? But that's exactly what we did. Like we watched this thing for a few minutes. Like, well, you guys ready to get back in the car? It's end of the day. We worked for 12 hours already today. Let's go home.
Bro, I'm telling you, that's a phenomenon in itself.
How weird, right? And looking back on it, I'm like, what were we doing? Like nobody took out their iPhones. Nobody did any of the stuff you would think we would do in this location or in this situation.
Yeah. I've had personal experiences where I've essentially done the same thing where I'm like, I'm going to bed and I just fall asleep. And it's weird because the more people that we've talked to, we're not the only people that do that stuff.
You hear that a lot.
You hear it's really it a strange, lot. Isn't it? It's very strange. It's weird on this bizarre subconscious level because there was a time, and it's funny too, because the first time we saw you, you were at Crypticon.
2019.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was trying to work up the courage to come up there and tell my stories, but I was really timid. I was like, I can't do it. I'm too nervous. And now I'm to the point in my life where I would do it without question.
Yeah.
But there was a time when I found something in the middle of my chest and I was able to get it out of my chest. Right.
Okay.
And I've told Steve about it and he's like, dude, what the fuck? So I got it out of my chest and I'm in the bathroom. I'm looking at this thing and I'm like, what is this little, not quite the size of a pea. About half the size of a pea. So if you can imagine that, roughly, you know, spherical, it's got jaggeds to it and everything else. I took a pair of tweezers, I squeezed it, and the tweezers bent around it.
Wow.
Which is weird. And keep in mind, like Steve knows, I've been into the weird all of my life, ever since at least third grade, because I had a personal experience in second or third grade. And since then, it spiraled me out of control into this field. What did I do with that thing? I threw it down the drain. Right down the drain. Yeah. And then I told Steve about it, and he's like, dude, because this is how our conversation, I would have an experience, and I would tell Steve about it, and he'd be like, dude, I was reading, and this is what happens. You know, it's like it's almost programmed in your brain, because there are tons of people that do the same thing you did. And I'm like,
just get rid of it.
Yeah, yeah, and then it just freaks you out even more. You're like, gosh dang it. You know,
you don't have control of your own right. choices or whatever. Yeah. How wild is that?
Yeah.
You hear about that sort of thing from time to time. Alien abductions is usually what that's tied to.
Yeah.
And there was a surgeon for a while. He's passed away now and I'm blanking on his name, but he sort of specialized in removing these things. Yep. He removed hundreds of them and, you know, doing testing. They never did figure out what a lot of them were.
Yeah. I think I know, I don't know the name either, but I think I know who you're referencing. Cause there was videos of like, people going in with tweezers and these things like moving away from the tweezers, just trying to get away. It's so bizarre.
Yeah.
Absolutely bizarre. But I mean, honestly, the alien side of it is what got me into the paranormal because I will swear on everything that I am that I saw one in my bedroom when I was a little kid and it scared the living daylights out of me.
Yeah. That all ties together. I mean, you have an implant or you had an implant. You had an experience. I mean, those two things, that's a good start to putting that story together, you know?
Oh, dude.
I don't know about a good start for sleeping for the rest of your life, but it's.
Yeah. I've had out there where I was living. I bet I have a solid 6 alien stories that I could tell you. And it happens from at least second or third grade all the way up until I move out of that area.
That's also consistent with a lot of stories. Yeah. You know, it's progressive over the years. It's like they watch us grow or something like that. Or they, they're researching the way we develop.
Yep. My wife was actually a part of one of them. So like I have a credible witness that experienced it with me. And she's like, you got to be kidding me right now. And I'm like, I told you it's weird out here.
Did they come through the mirrors? I always hear that they come through the mirrors.
No, but that's gross.
Yeah.
I don't think I've heard that. That's disgusting.
When I was a kid, this had to have been an Unsolved Mysteries plant that I got this information from. But ever since I was a kid in my bedroom, I was always terrified of mirrors. So I'd cover them up or just wouldn't have them because I was afraid they would come through the mirrors because that's what I kept hearing.
That's wild. I haven't heard that one. But we've had, from the same area where I've lived, we've had several alien stories out there from locals, submitting stories to us that fit the bill. Like there's something weird out there going on to this day.
Wow.
It's
bizarre. Well, I got a podcast you can call into.
I've thought about it. Trust me.
I would love to explore that. I don't think I've ever had an implant story. If I have, it's been a long time.
Yeah, I have that. I've got it where one of them was in my room and I was face to face with it. I had an experience where I heard them on my roof in conjunction with a black dog, and Steve told about that. And he's like, dude, you gotta read this alien abduction story I just read. It's so weird that you bring this up. And apparently black dogs have an affiliation with abduction stories. It just turns into this whole big thing. I used to have vivid dreams of lights coming in the windows and scanning the room. It just so happens that my wife, who was my girlfriend at the time, she was staying over and she starts shaking me and is like, Kyle. I'm like, what? She's like, there's somebody outside shining a flashlight through the window. And I'm like, get out of here. And she's like, I swear somebody is outside. So I get up, look outside, and off in the distance, there is a big orange ball floating in the sky at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And I did exactly like I'm looking at it. I know what's going on. And my wife's like, what is that? And I go, I literally go, somebody probably has a fire over there and it's reflecting off a cloud. Go to bed. And she's like, that's impossible, Kyle. And I go, listen, we are not having this conversation right now. Go to bed. Because I knew that if we started diving into it, I would be terrified and I'd never go back to sleep.
So you did have the choice to talk about it or not. You weren't.
Yes, I did have it. Yeah. But I'm like, no, man, we're not having this conversation right now. No way.
Well, I look forward to your phone call.
I'll do it. I'll call in. I'll call in with one of them. They're wild, man.
Yeah, I love stories like that. You know, I'd never heard about the black dog correlation. Owls, Mike Cleland talks about owls all the time, but I've never heard the black dogs.
Yep. Dude, it was bizarre that night. I'll try to give you a quick explanation. I was back in the day whenever we were kids talking on MSN Messenger. I don't know if you remember that.
No, of course.
Talking to my girlfriend, and I heard pitter-patter on the roof. And I'm like, what in the hell is that noise? But before that, recounting the story, when I got home, there was a big black dog out in the front of my parents' house. And I'm like, well, okay, that's weird. It was really dark, but it reminded me of a black lab. And then it started to growl at me when I got out. So I'm like, well, the hell with this? I'm going to go inside. I go inside. I'm looking out the window of the kitchen, and it's probably a solid 8 to 10 feet off the ground. This dog jumps up and hits that window, boom, right where I'm at. Scared the living daylights out of me because I'm like, what in the hell is going on right now? Jeez. And then, so I go out on MSN Messenger. I'm talking to my wife, my girlfriend at the time, wife, and I start to hear the pitter-patter on the roof, like somebody's running across the roof. So much so that I wake my mom up, and I'm like, Mom, I think somebody's trying to break into the house. She's like, you're crazy. Go back to bed. Like, whatever.
How familiar.
Yeah. And so I tell my wife, I'm like, all right, I keep hearing this. I'm going to go to bed. And as I'm not kidding at all, and it's terrifying to even think about, but as I'm walking through my house, I can hear those pitter-patters following me on the outside of the house. And right before my bedroom door, there's an offshoot to the right, which is like a utility room with a laundry and dryer, and there's a door to the outside there. It sounded like, this is how I pictured it, I don't know what it was, but it sounded like that dog was ramming its head against that door.
Jeez.
I go into my bedroom. I lay in bed. I have the TV on, and I can hear pounding beneath my window, just boom, 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 boom. I just turned the TV up as loud as I could and went to sleep. I'm like, I can't deal with this. This is terrifying. I don't know what's going on right now.
How long ago was this?
I was probably 16 or 17, so I'm 37 now, so probably about 20 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
terrifying, man. Terrifying.
It reminds me of Signs, you know, the M. Night Shyamalan film, the alien on the roof running around kind of thing. Like that visual just popped into my head.
Yeah, it's a good movie too. Very creepy.
Yeah, very creepy. Oh, I can only imagine living that.
Yeah, it was terrifying, dude. Absolutely terrifying.
And then to find an implant.
Later on. Yeah,
that's wild.
Yeah, not a great series of like. And Steve was always my go to paranormal guy. I'd be like, dude. Check, like, what do you think of this? And then he'd tell me about it, and I just have dread. I'm like, oh, man.
Watch what you ask for.
Yeah. Don't ask questions you don't want answers to.
Right, yeah.
Have you ever thought of, like, the regressive therapy? Now, I don't know how much I believe in that stuff, but there's a lot of science for it and a lot of science against it. But
yeah.
Something you thought about? Or?
I've thought about it, but I've always been a hard no because I'm like, you know what? Those are probably things I don't want to know about.
Then you know.
Yeah.
And then it's worse, right?
Like, it'd be great if it was like, no, Kyle, you were dreaming. This is all, you made it up in your head. Oh, great. That's great news. That's actually fantastic. However, if they confirm these things, well, then that's a different story. That's a whole new can of worms.
Have you ever heard the Barney Hill tapes where they put him under and ask him about his abductions? Like, it's terrifying to hear him recount that stuff. Just the sound of his voice alone is terrifying.
Yep. Yeah. I'm not trying to do that. That dude was a lot braver than I am.
I don't blame you. It messed him up. A lot of people say it killed him. You know, a few years later he died, and they say that was basically the cause of his death. He was all downhill from there.
That's bizarre, man. I didn't know that a lot of people attributed that to his death. That's crazy. But I could see if it affected your mental state that much.
Yeah.
I could see it happening. The stress alone of it, you know, stress will kill you.
Yeah. And, you know, even if it wasn't aliens, if it was some sort of kid, he got the wrong idea, you know, some sort of even prank, you know, or something like that. And he just believed it enough. That's wild.
It is scary stuff. It is wild.
I don't envy you one bit. you can keep all that stuff. I'll see a ghost. I'll see a cryptid. But the alien abduction stuff, that's all you.
Yeah. That's where I'm at. I don't mess with aliens. They can keep whatever they're doing. But the case he's referring to that I attributed the black dog phenomenon to is the Gulf Breeze flap in 87.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
There were a couple books out on that, and a lot of the people that experienced UFO phenomenon also experienced these rogue black dogs that were – a lot of them were aggressive, and they hadn't seen them in town before, and there were multiple people that had experienced it. When he started talking about it, I was like, holy crap, you know?
Wow.
Like, it kind of lines up.
Yeah, I was familiar with the Gulf Breeze stuff, but I didn't realize there were black dogs involved in all that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Back to Borrego. You hear a bunch of these of so-called triangles, right? Bennington, Bridgewater, Bermuda. What do you think it is about these areas that have so much that is like a magnet or a conductor for the paranormal? Even outside of that, like Skinwalker Ranch or Stardust Ranch, Blind Frog, like what do you think it is that set these things off in these particular areas?
Well, you know, I'll start by saying that I feel like the triangle part of that is all based on the Bermuda Triangle. You know, they set the shape. It's not the Bermuda Square or the Bermuda Circle or anything like that. So immediately we have a triangle. So I feel like a lot of these places, once they realize all the strange activities taking place, they sort of steal from that name. And that's exactly what we did. We talked about, is this going to be the zone of something? Or, you know, how are we going to call this? Or what are we going to call this? Now, as far as the activity is concerned, for us, it was the courts. It all came back to the courts or other underground features, I guess. There was a lot of caves and underground running water that's said to be under the park there as well. So those sort of things were sort of the catalyst for us. We kind of put a lot of stock in that sort of energy being developed by any of that stuff. The other places, you know, I don't know. I feel like each one of them might be different. Like you think of the Bennington Triangle in Vermont, I think is where that is. All these people come up missing. You know, that's sort of the manifestation there. Or Point Pleasant, which isn't a triangle per se, but it's certainly an area of high strangeness where you have the Mothman, you have Men in Black, you have these UFOs. It seems to manifest itself different in each of these places, but the underlying theme here is that they're all areas of high strangeness. They're all seemingly window areas. So I don't know if that means the veil is thinner there. There's a portal to another dimension, or if there's elements there that allow this sort of thing to happen, you know, quartz in our case. I don't know. I don't have answers to any of that stuff, but there certainly seems to be some sort of influence, I guess, going on there that keeps people interested enough to keep these stories flowing and reporting.
The quartz connection is interesting because we're not far from Alton, Illinois, which is often coined as one of the most haunted places in America. And we have huge limestone bluffs that run along the Great River Road. And there are pockets and quarries of quartz all along the bluffs as well. So it was cool to kind of see that tie in to something across the country.
Yeah. And that's another, you know, strange area. You have the Piesaw bird, and there was what was that other bird that was just a general thunderbird, I believe, wasn't it, that attacked a young man down there?
Yeah. I can't remember what town it was in exactly, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah. Somewhere right in that area.
Yep. It was interesting.
The desert's interesting because I was thinking, I was rolling that around in my head earlier as well. It's like, why would that particular location be so pronounced with paranormal activity? And it made me think of, and it's still kind of a work in progress, so to speak, but it made me think of the shamanic illness. Have you ever heard of that?
I'm not familiar, no.
So
or I might be and don't know it by name.
Yeah, you probably are. But you have the idea behind people becoming shamans. They're usually contacted by spirits during like a severe sickness or a bad accident. Like essentially, if you think about it, they're contacted by the other side when they're right there on the brink of death.
Yeah, time of crisis.
Close to death. And it made me wonder, in conjunction with the desert, well, the desert is a place of, I don't want to say it like this, but that's how I'm going to say it, death. Like everything is right there on the lip. So what if there is something to that, you know? And like I said, it's a work in progress. It just kind of made me ponder it. It's just ironic that in one of my last episodes that we just ourselves learned about the shamanic illness.
And interesting.
Yeah. It just kind of made me think. I'm like, man, I mean, the desert is kind of full of where it's like there is life, but it's everything is right there on the cusp of essentially crossing to the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there's tons of Native American influence there, which probably be expected. But one of the things that really drew us to the area was the petroglyphs, the rock art there. And we did find one cave that seemed to have a representation of all the activity we were talking about. It had what looked like to me ghost lights, you know, these balls of light, or these, there was blue, green, I think yellow, something like that. So they're all different colors. There were these creatures that looked like Sasquatch to me. They were twice the size of all the other humanoids that they drew, and it had claws on its hands and long drooping arms, and you know, stuff like that. So to me, it seemed like a lot of this stuff had been witnessed and recorded before, you know, 1,000 years ago, perhaps maybe more. So, you know, the influence is certainly there. I don't know. You know, I can't speak for illness or anything like that, that's conjured a lot of this, but the desert, you know, like you said, you know, it's a place that's bare and open, and death is certainly something that's always present there. And it's not only present, but it's out in the open. You can't hide it. You know, there's nowhere to hide the gruesome part of nature there. So maybe there is something to it.
The ghost lights, for lack of a better term, I guess, is another interesting subject that you guys touched on. And in the fact that they're They're quite different in Borrego than a lot of other places that you hear about. Almost that they have a sentience about them, and their shapes are a lot different. They're larger, and I'm curious, like how that, like, did you experience anything in that nature?
Well, we did notice that there was a big difference between, you know, the ghost light phenomena in the park and other ghost light cases around the country. You know, you think of like the Paulding light in Michigan or the Marfa lights in Texas. They're the same almost nightly. They're in the same spot. They do the same thing. Very predictable. The lights here in the park are completely different. You'll see them all over the place. They're reported throughout the lowlands of the park, and they're shooting across the road. They're going over a peak. There's a story about them derailing a train. So they were seen on train tracks. So these things are all over the place. And like you said, they almost seem sentient, like there's some sort of intelligence behind them. They just kind of cruise throughout the desert. And even skeptics that we talked to, we interviewed one gentleman that worked for the parks department there in the county. And he's like, I don't believe in any of this stuff, but I've seen these lights. You know, I see stuff shoot across the road. You know, I'm driving out here late at night and suddenly this ball of light shoots in front of my car. I don't know what it is. I can't say it's paranormal, but he obviously doesn't know what it is, and it shocks him. And as a skeptic, that speaks volumes to me.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I couldn't. It's bizarre. I mean, I say this from a very skewed position, but it's bizarre whenever you have people that experience those things, and they're like, it's not weird. I mean, it's not paranormal. I don't know what it is, but it's definitely not that. And it's just for me, it's weird, you know. But like I said, I believe in just about everything. I mean, I guess you could spin it in a direction of like maybe this is some type of military experiment out there with the bases. Mm-hmm. They're flying drones. You know, is that of course that's a possibility. But I don't know. My brain just likes the fantastical more than logic, I guess.
Well, I feel like sometimes people don't want it to be paranormal because it's a tough pill to swallow. You know?
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
You have to face the music. You know, if it is, whatever this person saw is paranormal, then that opens a whole nother door to other realities they may not be willing or able to accept.
That's a very good point. Very good point. For a lot of people, that might break their psyche. Like you said, exactly. They might not be ready for that.
Yeah.
And that's fine. That is absolutely fine and understandable.
I can't blame them.
No, not at all.
Each person processes this stuff a different way.
Yeah.
And some of them just shut down and want nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Sometimes ignorance is bliss, man.
Sometimes
you just you need to leave that door shut.
Unfortunately, that's not how my ignorance works. It works a different way altogether, but.
We are in the same situation, my friend. We're not afraid to knock on many doors.
Yeah.
We've had our warnings several times, and we just keep doing our thing.
Well, wait till a helicopter buzzes you when you're the only thing within 100 miles, and you realize you might have went a little too far.
Yeah, that's when you were explaining that. I'm like, I guarantee they were keeping tabs on them. Guarantee.
Yeah.
Because you hear like places like Area 51, how they have Area 51's certified, quote-unquote, perimeter of the area. But you hear stories of them having motion sensors and stuff like that miles and miles beyond their actual perimeter.
Ground sensors.
Yeah, exactly. Ground sensors, all types of things out there.
Yeah. They don't always work, though. I saw a YouTube video recently. Are you guys familiar with Angry Grandma? I think she's called on Instagram or Twitter.
I've seen that.
TikTok, maybe.
Sounds familiar.
She's always cussing up a storm, and her grandson's always messing with her. Anyway, those two were headed out to Area 51. I don't know if the video is real or not. It looked real. But they drove like 10 miles past the line before they finally got stopped. And when they were stopped, shit hit the fan. So to speak, you know,
I bet.
Suddenly their personas went from, you know, angry grandma to terrified grandma.
Yeah.
She was pretty worried. They ended up letting them go, but I guess they were held at gunpoint for several hours where they were checking them out. But
wow.
From what I understand, if the video is true, they got further than anybody else has ever got, and they got there on accident.
Wow. That's even like more wild that they have no idea where they're at. They're just like, yeah, we're just driving. And then all of a sudden, you know, all the UFO nuts are in the back. They're like, how in the world did you pull this off? Well, we didn't know where we were at.
They missed the signs, apparently. The huge signs that says, we will shoot you if you come past us. Somehow they missed the barbed wire fence. They missed that as well.
Oh, my.
That kind of makes me think it might not be real, but maybe. It looked real. Like I said, I watched the whole thing, and it looked pretty real.
That's awesome. That's ridiculous, dude. Years and years of people plotting and buying high-dollar pairs or telescopes to look into that place, and all you got to do is act like you're lost.
Just be an angry grandma.
Yeah.
Smokey the Bear right in there.
That's hilarious, dude. That's awesome. Fantastic.
Well, we could chat all night, especially about the documentary, but we want to encourage everyone to go out and watch it. It is excellent. So if you want to let everybody know where they can find your show and where they can find the documentary, that would be wonderful.
Sure. You can find Shadows in the Desert, like I said, at Amazon Prime, Apple TV, a whole slew of other places. You can go to BoregoTriangle.com and see all of that. You can watch the trailer and get some behind-the-scenes stuff there as well. And Monsters Among Us, you can find every Thursday, basically anywhere you find podcasts. And you can find us on socials. Just search for Monsters Among Us.
Excellent. Everybody go. Who doesn't check it out, definitely check it out, which I'm sure most of you already know. But thanks again so much for taking the time out of your day, Derek, to hang out with us and chit-chat.
Of course. Thank you, guys.
It's been wonderful.
It's been awesome.
So with that being,
thank you.
With that being said, Hollow Cult, thanks for tuning in with us today. Everybody stay safe, stay weird, and check out Monsters Among Us podcast and Shadows in the Desert documentary.